Looking at USA Today, apparently people who traffic in all manner of goods and services on the internet are looking to the online porn industry to discover what's next, what's newest, what's best. Apparently, since the online porn industry is kind of on the cutting edge of how to use the internet to get their product out, other people who use the internet to get their products out are saying, hey, there we go. These guys are pretty good at marketing themselves and delivering their products. We're going to use what they're showing us. They were the first, the online porn industry, to use a lot of the things that we take for granted today when we use the internet to find information, when we use the internet to buy something. Is it a benefit? Is it good for us just because they know how to get their product as seamy as it is across to their customers? We'll talk about that in the first half hour of Issues Etc. Today, I'm Todd Wilkin. Jan LaRue will join us from Concerned Women for America to talk about that article and online pornography. If you saw it in USA Today, you probably were thinking along the same lines. In the second half hour of the program, Christian History Magazine has a new name, Christian History and Biography, and to that end, they have devoted almost an entire issue to John Newton. You might not be familiar with the name, but you certainly are familiar with one of his most popular and best-loved hymns. It was first called Faith's Estimate and Expectation or something like that. It later became known as, of course, Amazing Grace. How did a slave ship captain and a general ne'er-do-well become one of the greatest Reformation preachers in English history and the author of that hymn, Amazing Grace? We'll talk to Chris Armstrong of Christian History Magazine about that in the second half hour of Issues Etc. Today. Then we've got open lines, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just check my little sheet here. Yes, open lines, indeed. Open lines for the second hour of Issues Etc. National Religious Broadcasters has a publication. One of the sections they have is called Church Media. And they have an article in there written by a bigwig, highly paid consultant for church things called The Postmodern Church Building. It's simply an article describing what the postmodern church building will look like. I will describe it to you, give you some of my reactions, and I'd like your reaction as well. And if we have time during open lines, we'll also be hearing that sound we didn't get to yesterday from Judge Roy Moore, who says, although you might think he'd be in favor of a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, he isn't. And we'll find out why during open lines as well. Then, for the first 15 minutes of that third hour of Issues Etc., Dr. James Hitchcock of St. Louis University will join us to talk about another story that appeared in USA Today. How long is too long? Asking the question as Pope John Paul II very quickly becomes the second longest serving pope in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, second only to Pope Pius IX, who served 31 years, 7 months, 21 days. Pope John Paul, as of, next week, the end of this week, will pass Pope Leo XIII at 25 years, 5 months. Second longest serving pope in all of history. We'll find out whether or not papal term limits are even in the offing. James Hitchcock joins us in the third hour of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Jan LaRue is chief counsel for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. She joins us to talk about online pornography. Jan, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's always nice to be with you.
First of all, your reaction to the USA Today story that basically says, look, the online pornographers have been leading the way among web entrepreneurs in how to get their product across, and a lot of people are taking their cues from them.
Well, that's always been true of the porn industry. They have always been at the forefront of exploiting technology, so there's really nothing new here in USA Today. It sounds like USA yesterday, as a matter of fact. Porn industry was quick to get into Russia when the wall came down, and from the camera to the VCR, they were the first to exploit that, made billions off of 900 dial-a-porn, and on it goes.
When I think it was several years ago when the internet was really heating up and everyone was getting online and everyone was getting high speed and all that kind of stuff, Jan, someone observed that online you've got about 50% of the websites dedicated to porn, and the rest are obscure topics and maybe a few media outlets. But by and large, it is a pretty seamy neighborhood online. Has it changed?
Oh, not at all. It has worsened, especially during the Clinton administration when they had a hands-off policy toward prosecuting obscenity by the federal government. And the 3 years thus far of the Bush presidency and Attorney General Ashcroft, they are trying to turn things around, but they're way behind and trying desperately to catch up. When you look at 1998, the figures were about 72,000 porn sites. At the 2003, it is now 1,300,000. And Sex Tracker told us back in 2002 that number one and number four words, search words on the internet, were sex and porn. So it sells, and that's a tragedy.
Now let's talk about it then. In the terms of it as a money-making industry, after all, no one's giving anything away here. What are we talking about in terms of the dollar amounts that are being generated? Can anyone estimate it?
Well, the porn industry loves to brag about it. Adult Video News, which is the trade magazine for the smut industry, puts out its figures every year as to the increase in hardcore porn rentals and in hardcore porn video sales. And for 2002, they said there were $801 million in, or 801 million rentals, I should say, of hardcore porn, and 11.3 million sales of hardcore porn. And the estimates go that this is an international industry of about $56 billion, and at least 10 to 12 billion in the United States alone. And now the internet component of that is about 2 billion.
Jan, is there any regulatory agency in the United States that can claim oversight not only over the internet but over this kind of traffic material?
Oh, the internet is the most unregulated industry. It's so freewheeling. However, that does not mean there's nothing that the government cannot do, because we have very good federal obscenity and child pornography laws that are fully enforceable on the internet. And that was my point about the Clinton-Reno administration's doing nothing against obscenity for 8 years has put us in this deep hole we are in today, and why the hardcore porn industry is flourishing so much. And, you know, when you look at the material, as I have to do because of my job, you see that probably 90% of what is on the internet is prosecutable as hardcore pornography. And so the federal government has to, and under this administration, has committed itself to trying to make a difference in enforcing the laws.
How is that going to happen? Who gets to handle this hot potato?
Well, this is entirely under the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice for obscenity and child pornography. There's an entire section in the Department of Justice called the Child Exploitation and Obscenity Section. We call it CEOS, and that is their jurisdiction. And they also assist the 93 U.S. attorneys around the country to enforce the federal laws. And then there, is concurrent state jurisdiction for prosecuting obscenity and child pornography as well. So we're not without the resources. What we have lacked is a vigorous enforcement.
Was there, just refresh my memory, because this is vague for me, Jan, but was there a Supreme Court decision in about the last 5 years relative to child pornography, but it was virtual child pornography, and I seem to remember it being ruled to be Protected speech.
Yes, that was in 2002, and it was one of the most tragic rulings by the Supreme Court in history, in my opinion. Congress reacted to developing technology in the computer industry because of the capability of morphing child pornography, that is, you know, moving the head of one child onto the body of another or putting a child's face on the body of an adult, and then also completely generating images of children engaged in sexual acts to the point where they would be virtually indistinguishable from the real thing. And because of the fear, twofold, that this would virtually create a reasonable doubt in the minds of jurors in any child pornography case, is this a real child or is this a computer-generated child? And we would lose real child porn cases. And number two, that whether it's a real child or a simulated child, the tool is just as dangerous in the hands of a pedophile in the seduction process of a child. And so Congress reacted to that and included pseudo-child pornography and computer-generated child pornography in the federal statutes. And the case went through the courts all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And tragically, the court held that because it's not a real child, the images are protected by the First Amendment.
One of our regular guests here on Issues, Etc., Illinois Representative John Shimkus was instrumental in seeing to it that there was a new sector in the Internet basically chartered that was a kid's sector in the Internet. And it was supposed to have all sorts of protections. Other people talk about filters on your own computer or certain kinds of way of locking out content. Are these sufficient solutions to this problem?
No, not at all. And as a matter of fact, the Internet was created with public funds, and it ought to be safe anywhere on the Internet for children. And Congress has enacted laws to do that. One of them will be decided by the Supreme Court again this year, which would we call the electronic brown wrapper in the Child Online Protection Act, which would require those commercial content providers on the World Wide Web to stop making these teaser images of pornography available to children. It's a crime, and it would require them to avoid prosecution to have adults use either a personal identification number, personal access code, or a credit card in order to view the material. So it would not hinder adults, but it would protect children from viewing and accessing the material. So the court will rule on that this year. They just had oral argument in that case. And so, parents, I encourage all the time, use a clean internet service provider who will block porn and whatever else you want blocked from their server. Install good software on your home computer. Never allow your child online alone. Do all the common sense things that parents can do. But that doesn't mean it should all rest on a parent, and that children should be limited to just one section of the Internet. Supreme Court ruled over 30 years ago that, you know, parents have the right to have government assist them in protecting their children from this kind of sexually explicit material.
One issue before we go that we still also need to address, and that is kind of what has been called the bane of the email world, spam.
Yes.
This is one of those things where you could be sitting at home just minding your own business waiting for grandma to send you a picture of her begonias, and you get what it seemingly an innocuous email with an attachment, and if you're not on your guard and
right,
open it, you can find yourself face-to-face with this stuff, too.
Oh, a very explicit, deviant material. And sometimes you don't even have to open the attachment. It's just there in your face. And, you know, even the most liberal adults are complaining, enough is enough with this kind of thing. And that's why we need the federal laws on obscenity vigorously enforced. And we also need the kind of spam blocking software that's available so that, you know, you can protect yourself as much as possible.
Well, let's talk about it. You've talked about the obvious desire on everyone's part to protect children. What about protecting adults? Does online porn hurt adults as well?
Oh, absolutely. And if material is obscene, it doesn't matter that the recipient of it is an adult or even a consenting adult. The crime is knowingly using a facility of interstate commerce to produce or distribute the material or even to acquire it. And what people don't understand is that if you are in your own home and use your computer that is, you know, online and using an internet service provider to acquire hardcore pornography, you have violated the federal law as well. And so, there's just no defense for distributing it or acquiring it by adults.
Jan, how do you respond to someone who says, look, you're just a prude. You're obviously hung up on sex. What do you care what someone does in the privacy of their own home?
Well, this isn't just the privacy of your own home. This is clogging up interstate facilities, the mail, telephone lines, computer lines, whether it's, you know, a fax machine, whether it's flying it into the country, using government-supported interstate facilities of commerce to transport illegal material. I mean, it would be as ludicrous of a drug dealer to ask me why, you know, I care about what people do in the privacy of their home. There's rarely anything that people do in their own home that doesn't affect the rest of society. What impact does that material have on an individual? And we've got, you know, reams of law enforcement personnel. We've got sex offenders telling us what kind of impact hardcore pornography has had on them to actually duplicating it in their sex crimes on women and children. You know, we've got sexual harassment and hostile work environment complaints that is costing corporations, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. We have an estimate that the misuse of internet privileges by corporation employees is costing the gross national product about $56 billion a year. And so whether I'm in the privacy of my office or the privacy of my home, this is no excuse for violating federal law.
Finally, Jan, is pornography anti-woman?
Pornography is anti-woman in that it exploits women. It devalues us. We are only appreciated in pornography for our physical attributes, our body parts. Women are so degraded in pornography and dominated by men, but it is also anti-man, anti-child, anti-family. You know, I have, for your listeners, would visit our website, I have a couple of papers if they'd like more information on this. One I wrote about 15 months ago, it's called The Porn Ring Around Corporate White Collars Getting Filthy Rich, documenting how many, you know, billions of dollars mainstream corporations are making off of distribution of hardcore prosecutable pornography. And then the second one is more recent. It's Hardcore Harm, Why You Can't Be Soft on Porn, and explains how whatever social issue that you care about, pornography has an adverse impact upon it.
Jan LaRue, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you so much, Todd. Always a pleasure. God bless you.
Jan LaRue is Chief Counsel for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. You can visit their website. It's cwfa.org, cwfa.org, or call them right there in Washington, area code 202-488-7000. That's area code 202-488-7000.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
Well, of course, that's a hymn that needs no introduction or back announcement at all. Amazing Grace. Its author, John Newton, is the subject of the latest issue of Christian History and Biography magazine. And joining us for the remainder of this hour, Chris Armstrong, who is managing editor of Christian History and Biography magazine. The latest issue, of course, in keeping with their new format, deals mostly with the life of this man. We'll be talking about him for the remainder of this hour. Chris Armstrong, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Glad to be here as always.
We have only about 2 minutes here before we take a break at the bottom of the hour. Give us a brief thumbnail sketch of John Newton.
Well, I say in the article I do on Newton at the beginning of the magazine that his story was one really of two lives, and God is at the pivot point. And I think that's really the way he saw it, and always the way he characterized himself, as somebody who had a pretty rough early life, and certainly not a Christian life, as he was a slave captain, as he was aboard many ships, and actually tried to deconvert some of the Christians around him. But then he had an experience with God that transformed him and became really one of the most prominent ministers in England during the years between John Wesley in the early 1700s and Wilberforce at the end of the 1700s and the beginning of the 1800s.
So he stands between those two towering figures of Great Britain's religious movements at the time.
He really does, and he's just about everywhere during that phase. Everybody knows him. He corresponds. He's always got a pile of some 50-plus letters on his desk that he's responding to from evangelicals and leaders all across the nation.
Now, before we go to this break, I found it interesting that the original title of the hymn that he is most well known for, Amazing Grace, is nothing like the phrase Amazing Grace.
No, it was, now you may have to remind me of it. It's something like Faith's Review and Expectation.
That's exactly what it was.
He wrote these hymns most often to accompany sermons, and particularly biblical passages that were that the sermons were related to. And in this case, it's the story of it's a story about David, who's just flabbergasted that God has picked him in particular to sort of be God's man, and he's responding to that out of amazement at the grace of God. And so, in dealing with this passage, he writes a hymn to go along with it, and that's how it originated.
John Newton is our topic, and Chris Armstrong is our guest. When we come back from this break, we'll spend the remainder of this first hour of Issues Etc. reviewing the life that is very well summarized by the sentiments recorded in that hymn, Amazing Grace. We'll talk a bit about the hymn, too, but mostly about its author, John Newton, and get the details of his life. Chris Armstrong is our guest. He's managing editor of Christian History Magazine, the latest issue of Christian History and Biography Magazine. It's got a new title and something of a new format as well. Is a biography of John Newton. You can give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It didn't begin as it ended. We'll talk about the beginning and the first years of John Newton's life when we come back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. Listening to Issues Etc. Peeps, chocolate bunnies, colored eggs, all popular Easter gifts for young children. This Easter, why not give them something that will last? Something spiritual, like our Issues Etc. book of the month for March, Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. This new children's book explains how the life of Simon Peter is really a story about God's grace. You can browse before you buy on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Follow Me costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Follow Me contains simple language and colorful illustrations for a young child, grandchild, or godchild. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Eric Rotman. Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for March, 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on megacities in Japan. In Tokyo, the city population quadruples on weekdays as commuters dash off the trains and into their office buildings. The large number of commuters present new opportunities for sharing Christ's love and starting new churches. Japan Megacities for Christ is asking prayer for a number of new house churches to form in downtown Tokyo. The challenge will be communicating with Japanese businessmen and their families. They work long hours and may see the message of Christ as an intrusion on their private lives. In addition, cultural barriers exist. Pray God will spark a church planting movement among Japanese men in the greater Tokyo area. Get updates on prayer requests and mission opportunities around the world. Visit the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Last evening, the House of Representatives voted on House Resolution 519, expressing the sense of the House about the recent earthquake in San Luis Obispo County, California. A short time later, congressmen took up House Resolution 475, congratulating the San Jose Earthquakes for winning the 2003 Major League Soccer Cup. Interesting what we can do with words. A terrible thing like an earthquake becomes quite tame when we use the word for sports. A terrible thing like the cross. Is Mel Gibson's depiction sadistic? Josephus tells how Alexander Janneus crucified 800 Jews in the midst of the city. He had the throats of their wives and children cut before their eyes, and these executions he saw as he was drinking and lying down with his concubines. Nowadays we have tamed the word cross and think of jewelry. By taming words, we sometimes change our attitude about reality and end up deceiving ourselves. But along comes a real earthquake or a movie about one crucifixion, and we are jolted out of our world of comfy self-deception. And, last night House Resolution 392 congratulated the Detroit Shock for winning the 2003 WNBA championship. Don't you just love shock?
Hey. You've heard the saying, it's a jungle out there. That's true. But if you're like most of today's families, it's a jungle right here, right now. Find direction with Dr. James Dobson and focus on the family. Straight answers and solid advice for dealing with life in the jungle.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. We're talking about John Newton with Chris Armstrong. John Newton, of course, the author. You probably know his name as the author of Amazing Grace, but of course, there's so much more to this man's life and his legacy than simply one hymn. Chris mentioned before the break that often he wrote hymns, and he wrote hundreds. Often he wrote hymns to accompany particular sermons that he preached, and that was one of his legacies. Although I take it, Chris, that as a preacher, his beginnings were very, very rough.
They were indeed. The first time he was invited to preach, he just froze about halfway through and had to be rescued by the minister of the church where he was preaching. The second time, bound never to have this happen again, he memorized every word of what he was going to do, and he also held out the script of it in front of him, and he read it in such a wooden way that it wasn't really very much better. So it wasn't an auspicious beginning.
Tell us about the religious landscape in England at the time before we get into the particulars of Newton's life. What was the church like at this time?
A great question. The Anglican Church, of course, was the dominant church. There were non-conforming churches, a legacy and a leftover of an earlier age when the Puritans had become so prominent as to really take over power with under Oliver Cromwell, the civil wars of the 1640s. But by the time Newton is born in 1725, the established church had cooled considerably, both to Calvinist teachings and really to any form of enthusiasm or sect building outside of the church. And in itself, Anglican religion had stretched out between two extremes. One of them was an emphasis on moderation, the benevolence of God, and basically practical virtue really evolved into kind of a moralism without a really a Christ in a redemptive sense. And on the other side, an emphasis on high churchmanship, on the personal pursuit of holiness, which involved rigorous self-examination and preparation, but also could tend to be a little bit moralistic, and this was something that people like John Wesley came up through. You may be familiar with Wesley's Holy Club at Oxford, and he wrestled with that and finally felt released in his famous experience of having his heart strangely warmed when he heard a reading of Romans that talked more about the grace of God and really returned to some of the emphasis on God's sovereignty, on being born again, that was part of the Calvinist tradition. So that Calvinist tradition was kind of being set aside by and large by the church, at least during Wesley's early years. I'm sorry, Newton's early years and Wesley's.
Newton begins in a Christian home, but at a very young age, things take a turn for him. Tell us about this.
Well, his mother was one of this barely 1% of the population of the city where he was born in London. She was part of a Puritan-derived group outside of the established church, Congregationalist group. There were a few Congregationalists and Presbyterians and so forth, and it was a fairly lively group. However, she trained him well, trained him to memorize the Westminster Catechism, to read pious books, and to attend to his spiritual life and his behavior. But his mom dies when he's 7, and he's left with his in the more less religious and more distant care of his sea captain father. And so, during his formative adolescent years, he's going across the seas with his dad and picks up a few bad habits, which later on, when he ends up on voyages without his dad, sort of come to full fruition, and he really has kind of the classic wild youth, very, very disregarding of the faith his mom had taught him, and really, as I said before the break, even seeking to convince others that Christianity was more a pain in the neck than anything, and it's well gotten rid of.
There is one person that he runs across, I recall from my reading, by the first name of Job, a fellow sailor who he manages to convince against the Christian faith, but later in life, after Newton himself has returned to the Christian faith, he meets this guy again. Tell us the story.
That was just a real shaking experience for Newton. As you say, he had come to faith. He had been challenged in his heart by to return to the faith of his mother in his young years. And as he prepares for his second voyage as a captain, still a slaving captain, and he is still in the slave trade during his first years as a Christian, although increasingly he's uncomfortable with this and finally comes to be a very strong abolitionist along with the young Wilberforce. But at this point, he's going on to his second voyage, and here comes this young man, Job Lewis, who he had essentially deconverted. And he was, by that point, a hardened sinner. He was cursing, inflicting his bad temper on the crew, and also flouting Newton's authority. Newton takes him on board as kind of a special assistant and lives to regret that. Job Lewis, on the other hand, does not live. He goes to a landfall at one point, and essentially his dissipated lifestyle combines with the local climate to fell him with a serious fever, and he dies, as was later reported to Newton, screaming that he was going to hell, but unable and unwilling to seek God's mercy. And Newton, as you can imagine, is quite torn up about this. It's part of, I think, Newton's own development when he realizes at this point that he's being called to a full-time ministry.
What is it, before he begins to really a long pursuit of a Christian pulpit, what is it that finally, after kind of many stops and starts and swinging back and forth like a pendulum spiritually, that finally lands him firmly in the Christian faith again?
Well, he reports it as to being a particular event when he's in the midst of a raging storm. He's tied to the ship to prevent being washed away, bailing. His life is passing before his eyes. He feels that he's experienced warnings and deliverances from God before that. He's had a dream at one point where is given a valuable ring, and he throws it overboard, and then it's brought back to him. And this is a symbol for really the valuable truths of the gospel, which he realizes, I think, all the while that he's chucked overboard. And in any case, he finally breathes a prayer during this storm. It's a sort of a very thin start. He slides back from it a number of times into swearing and bad behavior and so forth. But it really is the beginning of the opening of his heart and his development as a mature Christian. He was isolated on these voyages from any other Christian influence. It's not until many, many years after this event that he meets a fellow captain who is also a Christian, who really helps to put him on a firm footing.
He begins at, I guess, probably the age of about 40 to think seriously about a position in the church. It's not easy for him, is it?
It isn't. I mean, he's been known by that time. He's had a number of years working as what's called a tide surveyor, which is essentially a government position in which you board vessels as they enter the port and you search for smuggled goods. And at that point, the Seven Years' War is breaking out in 1756. Maritime traffic is falling off, and he doesn't have much to do at the office. So he starts traveling all over England, visiting. He's an on-fire Christian at this point. He goes to hear George Whitefield preach, John Wesley's famous colleague who helped to start the American Great Awakening. And he just he sees increasingly that this is the vocation for him. And he begins to pursue, as you say, ordination in the established church, where he believes he's being called. But the established church is not so happy about him. He hangs around with too many Methodists and too many kind of wild characters. They're not too happy about Whitefield either. And he's tarred with the same brush as an enthusiast. And so several applications are turned down for his ordination.
Where does he finally find a pulpit?
It's a small town in the Midlands of England called Olney. A few years before he arrived there, there had been only 500 houses and 2,000 inhabitants. I like to think of this place in terms of Tolkien also spent some, J.R.R. Tolkien spent some childhood years here, as we discovered doing that issue, and kind of modeled the Shire after this area. It's a very rural area. The town was a town of craftspeople and tradespeople, who were often quite poor. Lace making was their primary industry, and the price of lace fluctuated so badly that the majority of the town was sometimes on the ragged edge of poverty. And he just pours himself into this community, and that was a community for whom he wrote Amazing Grace and many other hymns.
And how long does he stay there?
He stays there for decades. I'm not remembering offhand the exact date. He is so kind-hearted and so encouraging of lay participation there that this ends up kind of being his Achilles heel. He starts many groups. He encourages prayer groups and individual home groups and small groups and so forth. And eventually, as his biographers tend to agree, he kind of loses his authority in the community. And when they take a turn really for the sort of towards deadness in religion, they won't listen to him anymore, and they finally sort of become disgruntled with him and let him know that he's not welcome. This, I think, clearly was all in God's plan, because where he ends up next is in London, in probably the most prominent parish in the country. He's rector of St. Mary Woolnoth, where the Lord Mayor attended and many other important people. It was within the shadow of the governmental buildings there. And he only increases in national influence after that. As I said before the break, hundreds of letters, spiritual advice to key people in government. The one we remember best is William Wilberforce, whose efforts eventually resulted in the abolishing of the slave trade.
And he is kind of becomes a not only a celebrity, but also a national figure, a figure of England at this time, one of these figures that epitomizes that nation. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he really did. I'm not sure if I can sort of come up with all of the ways in which that's true, in which he epitomizes England, but he certainly becomes a central figure in the growth of evangelicalism. I think of this as evangelicalism's wonder years. And by evangelicalism, I mean Christians who are concerned to to follow and preach the gospel, to read and adjust, and orient their lives according to the Bible in ways that go beyond, as I said, some of the moralistic faith that had creeped into the Anglican Church. And so, you know, in Wesley's early years, folks like this, like Wesley and Whitfield and eventually Newton, the evangelicals, are really a small minority in England. But by the end of Newton's life, through his influence and, of course, the influence of Wesley and others, but many within the Anglican Church, you may remember John Wesley never separated during his lifetime from the Church of England, never intended to. There's a real revival and a complete renovation of the nation that takes place. And Newton is not a name we usually associate with this, so it was fascinating to read of a man who stays within a Church of England pulpit, always associates himself with Anglicanism, and is able to really renew many people and to forward the evangelical revival in that country. It was a fascinating story for me to find out about. I knew very little about Newton.
We're talking about John Newton. Chris Armstrong is our guest, managing editor of Christian History and Biography magazine. The latest issue of the magazine is a biography of John Newton himself, also the author of Amazing Grace. I want to talk about the story of that hymn as well, how it went from being essentially obscure to being arguably the most famous Christian hymn in the Western world. Before we get to that, the slave trade is an issue that is woven into Newton's life. You mentioned he was a slave trading captain. He was part of the trade even into the years after his conversion. Give us the evolution of his thought and his mind on this issue.
Yeah, you know, biographers have to be honest about this. As much as they do love Newton, and we do, that he really underwent a progressive enlightenment and a progressive conviction about this trade. He resented it, shortly after becoming a Christian. He resented it for keeping him away from his beloved wife, Mary. He resented it for the discomforts that he was involved with, but he didn't show a lot of sympathy for the slaves themselves in his early years. He really is, I think, a participant in the widespread racism of the day that didn't regard other races as being somehow on a level with the white or the English in particular. But he really, I think, through a process of conviction of the Holy Spirit and through the help of his young protege William Wilberforce, he comes to see the depths of the slave trade's sinfulness. And towards the end of his life, in 1788, there are years of debate going on over the issue of whether the slave trade should be shut down in Parliament. And Prime Minister William Pitt finally strikes a committee of his Privy Council to investigate the trade. And they find that the only man in England who both has an intimate knowledge of the trade and is dead set against it and is willing to paint the harrowing details of it is John Newton. They call him in as a witness, essentially the star witness. And it is, in part, his witness that leads to the abolition of the trade in England. He was very sure that it was a sinful trade, and that it had, its treatment of Africans was completely wrong and sinful by the end of his life. But it was a progress. It was a process for him.
He considered himself, at the end of his life, according to his epitaph, an infidel, a libertine. And then he says, a servant of slaves in Africa, a reference to some time he spent really on the wrong end of the slave trade. Tell us that brief story.
He was the assistant of a slave trader who was running a large, what they call a slave factory in the Indies. And he ends up getting on the wrong side of his white master's African mistress, who is a princess or a woman of some importance in the local tribe, and ends up really chained up, being mistreated, deprived of food by this mistress, abused, verbally and physically by her, and caused to have to serve even the slaves in that circumstance. Some of them even began to have mercy on him and to take letters back and forth to ships that were coming in and out so that he could, he actually did reach his father within about a year, who sent someone to come and rescue him. But yeah, he really hit bottom at that point, and I think it caused him to think a little bit about where he was. Of course, as soon as he's released from that, he begins to make plans again for being a fat cat slave trader, and it's years later that he has his conversion experience. But That was in his very early years.
Now let's talk about the hymn Amazing Grace. You mentioned before it started out as simply called Faith's Review and Expectation, tied to a sermon that Newton had written from, what was the text? Kind of an obscure passage.
Yeah, the passage is in Chronicles. Again, it's David. It's 1 Chronicles 17, chapter 17, verses 16 and 17. And it's David responding to God's promise that he'll maintain David's line in his kingdom forever. And David says, "Who am I, O Lord God, and what is mine house that you have brought me hitherto?" And I think Newton could relate very deeply to that sentiment. You know, who am I? He was always very realistic about the sin in the heart of every man and felt that, that it was only, again, through the grace of God that he'd been led himself to a fruitful ministry in the kingdom.
But this hymn in his native country and at the time is very obscure. How has it become the most well-known, perhaps one of the best-loved Christian hymns in the Western world, especially in America?
It really is the American milieu that brings this to the kind of fame that it now has. We have a quote at the beginning of our article, wonderful piece by a man named Stephen Turner. Steve Turner wrote a book, American Grace, The Story of America's Most Beloved Song. I recommend it. He does a great job of explaining how, this progress. But he quotes, there's a British hymnologist, John Julian, 1892, okay, so many, many years after Newton's death, writes that Amazing Grace really is far from being a good example of Newton's work. So it really wasn't even getting a lot of respect, you know, close to the turn of the century in England. But for various reasons, it's picked up as sort of an anthem of America as early as the frontier years, the camp meeting years. When it becomes associated with a tune that Newton never wrote, a tune of obscure origins, some people think Scottish origins, in 1829 in a book called Columbian Harmony. Newton's words appear with this tune, and Steve Turner writes that the song just fits the words so well. You know, behind amazing, there's the music that has a sense of awe to it. Behind the word grace, it sounds graceful. There's a rise at the point of confession, as though the author was stepping out in the open and making a bold declaration. And Turner also argues that this hit America at a point where, you know, lines like dangers, toils, and snares, they could really associate on many levels with this, the frontier workers who faced such hardship. And the slaves eventually pick it up, and it really becomes an anthem for them. Interestingly enough, this slave trader's song, of course, by the time he wrote it, he had repudiated the slave trade. And I'm not sure many of the slaves knew the background. They simply knew that the words rung true with the gospel they knew, and the music was beautiful.
So there is a bit of felicitous irony here. This man who had traded in slaves is the author of an anthem that becomes, for the Christian slaves in the United States, while slavery still thrived, a source of great comfort to them.
That's right. They might be downtrodden, they might be enslaved, but there were still victories to be gained. There was still a God who cared about them and through his grace could release them in spiritual ways, and they hoped eventually in physical ways, of course.
Now, I wanted to ask you before we let you go here, there's been a minor, or apparently minor, change in the name of Christian History's magazine. It's now Christian History and Biography, and I noticed that the format has also changed a little bit. There's a little more feature element to the magazine. Tell us about this.
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. It's something that reflects, the change in name, I think, reflects what we've always tried to do, which is to major, or at least to feature, the human sides of the stories we tell. So even when we're talking about theological matters, we embed it in the real personality and drama and story of what's going on. I think that's a wonderful way to access history, and it doesn't mean compromising the scholarship or the integrity of the history. We've certainly tried not to do that. But the new features you mentioned, we now include a number of departments that connect, we hope, help people connect with the church, the history of their church, history of our faith, through current discoveries, sites, and events, through dramatic events of the past, through testimonies of Christian leaders from today whose lives have been changed. There's a piece from a pastor as well known in the country, Gordon MacDonald, about his encounter with Charles Simeon, an English evangelical, and we'll do that in the future, and so on. So there's really a little bit of something for everyone, we hope, in every issue. If you aren't enamored of John Newton for that issue, you can at least read some things that will really allow you to connect with the history of your faith.
It is all very interesting stuff. What's in the upcoming issue of Christian History and Biography?
Well, we're taking on something of a controversial issue, two issues from now, which is what the Church has done with Mary, the mother of Jesus. And we're doing this in a very gospel-centered and gospel-focused way, going through the episodes of her life in an issue that will come out a few months before Christmas. Our next issue upcoming is on the holiness movement in America, and a little-known woman who started that movement really is the mother of such denominations as the Nazarenes, the Church of God Anderson, and the grandmother of Pentecostalism, and her name is Phoebe Palmer. We're looking forward to sharing that story with our readers.
It is always interesting, Chris, and thank you very much for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Chris Armstrong is managing editor of Christian History and Biography magazine, the latest issue devoted to the life of John Newton, among the other features you'll find there. Now, you can check out the website for Christian History and Biography magazine by going to ours, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org is the website address. Under the section called Links with Regular Guests, just click on that, scroll down, and you'll find a direct link to Chris Armstrong and Christian History and Biography magazine, or if you'd like to know how to receive Christian History and Biography, call 1-800-873-6986. That's 1-800-873-6986. When we come back from this break, hour two of Issues Etc. and open lines for your questions and your comments. Hopefully, if we have time, we'll be hearing from Judge Roy Moore on his objections to a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. He lays out his case, and we'll bring that to you. But first, I want to talk about something I came across in National Religious Broadcasters magazine under the church media section, the Postmodern Church Building. We'll read parts of this description to you with some of my own reaction. I'd like your reaction as well. It used to be that the church building was a place where you walked in, people assembled. There was perhaps a pulpit, an altar, eventually electric lights, heat, air conditioning, things like that, all the modern conveniences. Apparently, that's not enough now. We'll find out what at least one person thinks lies ahead for the postmodern church building during Open Lines after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.